When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We sometimes feel compelled to do it ourselves to save money. We feel compelled to do it ourselves because it sounds too expensive to go hire someone. Any good employee, they will never be a liability to your company. The cost is irrelevant.
This can't be it. There has to be more. Wait, am I crazy? No. If you're yearning for more and working hard to make your dreams a reality, then you're in the right place. Welcome to Dreamcatchers. It's the only show committed to helping you self-actualize and then transcend, leaving you with the legacy you've always desired. Listen in on conversations with successful philanthropists, entrepreneurs, and founders every week as we connect with them for inspiration, education, and direction. Your host, Jerome Myers, is here to help you exit the matrix and transform into a leader of your own revolution. The question is, do you believe your dreams should be real?
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Dreamcatchers podcast. I'm your host, Jerome. And when I tell you, you're in for a treat today, we went to the West Coast, far left coast, and we found Brandon Vaughn, and we are going to talk about one of the wild rides of founders and making essence. Brandon, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Jerome. Thanks for having me on, man.
Man, it's an honor to have you on. So I was asking you right before we hopped on if you had a job, and you're like, no. I worked for my dad a little bit after I graduated, or through high school, and a little bit after I graduated. But other than that, I've been self-employed my entire journey. So tell me, man, how does one get the gusto, the kahunas to just say, I'm going to figure this out on my own instead of going to get a good job after going to a good school and getting good grades and following the good old American dream?
I think, you know, part of it has to do with being inspired by my father. So my dad was an entrepreneur, but he was the kind of entrepreneur that owned a job rather than kind of owned a business. So he was an owner operator window cleaner. So my whole childhood was my dad owning All Clean Window Service, where he was the owner operator window cleaner. He was on the tools, on the ladder, on the truck every single day, 5 days a week. And actually, when I turned 13, I dropped out of school and homeschooled instead so I could work with my dad full time. So I actually was working with him 40 hours a week since the age of 13. And it was actually a pretty amazing education to just kind of see my dad doing his thing, you know, talking to customers, selling jobs, doing quotes. And it just kind of gave me this really unique lens that I've always kind of been drawn towards, which is doing my own thing. So it was a very, very kind of unique, you know, environment to kind of be raised like that.
Well, it sounds like you got exposure to running a business without having to be responsible for all the things in the business. So I assume that gave you a head start on starting your own company. So is your dad still in the business, or what happened with the business that he was running?
So actually, you know, there's something that I like to talk to people about, and that's the bus factor. And the bus factor is a score of how many people in your company need to be hit by a bus, either physically or metaphorically, for the business to cease to exist. My dad's score was 1. If anything happened to him, business would kind of cease to exist. So 2012, you know, I the day I turned 18, I got my own business license. I went out and had several entrepreneurial ventures, most of them like, you know, medium success, small success / total epic failures. But 2012, my dad was diagnosed with heart disease. And the doctors told him that he couldn't work physically anymore in the business. So his business had to cease to exist. So that was actually the time when I came back to my dad to try to help him kind of figure out how to make that transition and make sure that my parents were taken care of okay. Because at the time, they had no savings, no retirement, no backup plan. So it was kind of a stressful event to happen in his life when, you know, his job of 33 years, his business of 33 years, just kind of got taken away from him.
And so in that, I'll call it an unraveling. Did you sell it? Did you just unwinded? Did you just say, hey, I'm going to move in and take care of you guys? Like, how'd it play out?
Well, we had a meeting, and my dad was very emotional during that meeting. He told me, you know, son, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, maybe I'll just be a Walmart greeter. And that was probably like one of the worst things to kind of hear my dad say was, you know, with his business. So we actually set up a way to be able to, I bought the business for my dad, and the business was doing about $8,000 a month at the time. And I told him, okay, I'll buy the business for $3,000 a month for life. And that'd be enough to kind of like supplement his Social Security, allow him to be able to retire, and they'd be like, okay. And I had no clue what I was doing. I mean, you know, $3,000 a month off $8,000 a month of income. Like that was, I realized really quickly, like, okay, I'm out of money. I need to go grow this thing and try to develop it and try to kind of expand my own, you know, skill set as an entrepreneur who up to this point had not been really crushing in the entrepreneurial world. You know, had a lot of solo operator businesses myself, as well as lost almost everything during the 08, 07, 08, you know, crash. I was in construction at the time, had a construction business, tanked that one pretty hard. So it was definitely a unique opportunity that was terrifying, exciting, kind of all at the same time, but certainly pushed me outside my comfort zone really, really quickly.
Okay. So you're still here, I assume, that you figured out how to grow it.
It was a journey, that's for sure. I had lots of really great mentors and coaches, went to the SBA, joined their advisory program, got paired up with a coach. Her name was Kedma. And she really kind of walked me through a lot of challenges, overcoming some self-limiting beliefs. This is actually kind of what it looked like. I don't know if you can see that picture but that's my dad and I and me back on the tools. And pretty much from, you know, from that point forward, you know, I went in and grew that business from zero over the course of the next 5.5 years to about 70 employees doing about $500K a month in revenue. Just
that's a long way from $8,000, my friend.
Yeah, it was a trip. It was definitely a trip, and it certainly didn't do it because I'm a smart genius. That, you know, I didn't go to school, I didn't go to college. You know, stumbled my way through it. Had lots of, you know, ups and downs along the way. I feel like I've made every single mistake that a business owner could make, and have a PhD in pain and suffering probably more instead of anything else on the college side. But I certainly was blessed to find a lot of really great team members. And that really kind of changed everything for me, was the people side of things.
Wow. So when you stepped into the one bus business, I like that. You were chief everything officer, I think. Is that fair? Or was your dad still helping out, kind of cheating? How did that go?
Yeah, I was chief everything officer for sure. So my dad, he retired at that point in time. He was working, you know, as his health would allow him to, as an employee, helping out with quotes. He couldn't do any more physical labor. And so he was kind of helping me with quotes on just a really part-time basis. But even that kind of subsided relatively quickly as he really was looking to kind of just retire. And he needed to, his health needed him to do that. So, you know, hired my first employees, and it was really hard for me to get to a place in the business mentally where I could get off the tools. I could stop doing the thing and start kind of focusing on the other aspects of the business. But I really quickly realized that when I could just focus 100% on just building systems and processes and attracting the right kind of people into the company to help me kind of grow this thing, it didn't take me long to realize that I couldn't do it all myself. I couldn't do everything. And I certainly couldn't do it as well as other people could come in and do it, which, you know, a lot of letting go of ego and pride, and understanding that there are other people that you should bring into your company to tell you what to do instead of you just tell them what to do, was a pretty big transformational mindset shift for me that really kind of broke my previous pattern of doing everything in every one of my previous, you know, entrepreneurial ventures, which actually I credit to why All Clean grew as quickly as it did from that point forward.
Got it. So your first hire, who was that? And did it work out the first go around?
My first hire was an assistant technician who was, you know, it's a fancy term for another window cleaner, help me come in, you know, another laborer. And I kind of felt into the DIY death trap of teaching someone to know everything that I knew. And we got to a point where, you know, really quickly in that arrangement, I realized that he wanted and felt like he deserved kind of more than what we, you know, he really had kind of like injected into the business. And so it didn't end up working out. I learned a lot on just what it meant to be a good boss and how being a good boss is not just, you know, promising how awesome this is going to be and how great everything's going to be, and instead holding people accountable and, you know, holding a little bit more rules and processes and regulatory things in place. So I'd say the failure of the relationship really was due to my own faults. And certainly that's been the case in anything that has, you know, caused some bumps in the road of being an entrepreneur. It's always the owner's fault. It really is. It's always our fault as CEO. We're always the bottleneck in our companies. And the sooner we can recognize that, the better off we are.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Take ownership so that you continue to have agency. The moment that you give up your agency or blaming somebody else is the moment that you're helpless and defenseless. So that's a great lesson. Thanks for offering that. So the first person didn't work out. You hired some more people, figured out. Eventually you had 70 employees. Was there any point where you got out of the day-to-day operation?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So in my business, the way that I've always looked at things in the service company is there's four departments: marketing, admin, production, and sales. So, you know, marketing, getting all the leads in; admin, scheduling, dispatching work; back end office, production, actually doing the thing, you know, whatever that thing is. You know, in our case, it was cleaning. So vehicles, equipment, inventory, people to actually go do the thing, and then sales. So the thing that I really kind of focused on through the help of mentors and, you know, lots of people along the way, much, much smarter than me, was someone has to own each one of those departments. It can't just be you. At the end of the day, you have to be the executive that places all those people in the right seat of each one of those departments, and they own it. So it got to a point where I had my director of each one of those departments, and we called ourselves the Avengers. Each one of them came up with their own superhero name. So, you know, my director of admin was the Flash. My director of production was Captain America. Director of sales was the Hulk. And then I was the Invisible Man. And so like we would get on Zoom, and sometimes I would even like turn off my camera and, you know, kind of make a joke out of it. But at that point in time, I was probably working less than 5 hours a week in the business. I never had an office for myself in any of our locations that we had, which at that point in time, we had three, and work from home pretty much every single day. And, you know, at that point, your responsibility or my responsibility was holding everyone accountable, setting the vision, making sure that the business was healthy. And we had those directors meetings where everyone just kind of reported their KPIs, their instrumentation, would let us know that we were doing well. And it was great. It was the first time that I had this epiphany moment in my life where, wow, a business could actually be an asset, like owning a piece of commercial real estate or, you know, owning some tangible property. And that was really an amazing thing. I ended up selling that business in 2018. It was my first real exit, I'll call it. And I have since then had several more and have had kind of this awakening of, you know, what's kind of possible when you get the right people in the right place. And you don't have to just be a slave to time. And you can really kind of break free and leverage yourself a lot more.
I'm trading those hours for dollars, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right. That's right. Time is infinitely more valuable than money. You can give money away. You can lose it. You can earn it. But time, it's a currency that we spend every hour, every minute, every second, whether we want to or not. And we don't know how much finite amount we have left. We don't have a bank account balance for our time that we can just go and check. And so too often, the trap that I fell into when I was growing these businesses was I would trade my time because I felt like I had an infinite amount of it. You know, I'd work the nights and the weekends. My family would never see me. My wife, my kids would never see me. I'd be working 80 hours a week. And it really kind of comes from this place of ego where business owners, especially including myself, you know, feel like we have this infinite amount that just replenishes itself. Why are we spending time to save money when we should be spending money to save time? And we spend that money by investing in good teammates. And that's how you build wealth. That's how you think more like an investor as opposed to just, you know, someone with a job.
This is good stuff. What was the most important step in getting out of the day-to-day operation?
I'd say I'd break it down into two parts, people, certainly, and then systems. So a system, the way I define it, is a documented process on how to do something important in your business. Yeah. But that key word is documented, and it can be documented in a video format, a written format, a checklist of some kind. It has to exist somewhere else other than in your brain. And if you have anyone coming to you and asking you, hey, boss, how do we do this thing? Hey, boss, I need to do this. And you're the one that knows how to do it and no one else knows how to do it. Or worse yet, only one other person knows how to do it in the company.
One bus.
You have to make it free. Yeah, there's back to your bus factor again, right? So you have to make it openly accessible. And so when I started working on, you know, building like a company-wide learning management system, which is a software program where you can load in all your videos and your quizzes and your checklists and your documents, it kind of democratized knowledge of how to do everything in our business. And when someone came in as a new employee, rather than coming to me and me teaching them all the stuff, they'd go to our central hub, and then that would do there. And then the people part of it, you know, especially middle managers, executives, C-level suites, individuals as the company scaled, those are really critical because, you know, they would bring a whole nother skill set that I didn't possess and rounded out my weaknesses and really kind of taught me that almost everyone else can run the business better than I can because I'm ADD and very hard to focus and really, really struggle with checklists and tasks and getting things done and accomplished. So surrounding myself with integrators and operators that thrive in that kind of situation was a real big key as well to getting out of the day-to-day.
This is cool. So, and at any point, did you create a board for your company or any of your companies?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do have a board for one of my companies right now that is a SaaS company that's kind of in startup phase right now, software as a service, SaaS. And that they're someone that's, you know, our trusted advisors that, you know, that I've learned to connect with and network over time to kind of put some of those together. But in lieu of a more formal board, I've always had a trusted board of advisors, so to speak, a really good solid business attorney, a really good solid accountant that helped me out with the taxes side of things, a really good solid HR advisor, you know, that could advise me on people situations and offer letters and understanding and navigating the tricky world of HR. It is very, very tricky. And I've always been surrounded with, you know, coaches and mentors and have always had a coach since I really kind of started that journey of All Clean. Ever since then, I've never been without a coach. So you can have an informal board of advisors and everyone should, you know, have that type of a board, so to speak.
Got it. So the SaaS company's still early, so I won't dive deep on that one, but we'll go back to All Clean now. And so I think I heard you say you sold it in 2018.
Yes.
Okay. I know you bought the business from your dad, but what was your first exposure to someone selling a business? Was that it?
You mean like as far as my personal experience or just someone in general?
Your personal, well, someone in general, because at some point somebody's got to make you aware that you can sell and buy and sell a business. Like there is a monopoly for business, right? Like people don't actually think about selling those entities.
Yeah, I had heard other stories of other founders and individuals and mentors and coaches that have talked, you know, that, you know, told me about their story of exiting. And it did kind of open my eyes a little bit more to, wow, you're building something that has tangible value and someone would, you know, buy this for millions of dollars. Like, that's kind of crazy. You know, if I calculate up, okay, I built this company in about 5.5 years and I divide up my exit number by how many years that was, like I made really good money during that time period, better than I ever have before in my life. And so that was an eye-opening moment for me. And when the opportunity came up to sell this company, I wasn't actually actively looking to sell the business, but I had kind of given myself a little bit of a timeline. I told my wife during a really dark time period in my entrepreneurial journey, I lost my brother at the time. I was very stressed out. It was very difficult. I told her, hey, give me 5 years. I'll build this business up to a point and sell it. So I had that kind of vision for selling it, but the exit event actually happened sooner than when I was expecting it to. I was speaking at an event and two brothers actually came up and approached me and took us out for lunch and made an offer that was, you know, really great and made me excited about the opportunity and the prospects and was earlier than I was expecting. But I did always have that a little bit on the horizon and kind of understood what that meant. But let me tell you, going through that exit event was one of the coolest entrepreneurial educational things that's ever happened to me. Like, it felt like, you know, I never went to college. It felt like a little, you know, mini MBA crash course. And I learned so much for the whole process. And that one single event has helped me with, you know, future acquisitions, future exits, and, you know, even with coaching. So, you know, people always ask me, do I regret selling? I don't, but it absolutely was a good educational experience for me.
So this is good. I'm glad you went there. So one, how'd you know that the offer was good? How'd you guys establish a valuation?
It was based on a multiple of EBITDA. Okay. And I had mentors and coaches that, you know, I would bounce those ideas off. It was a good valuation, a good, you know, on the higher range of an EBITDA multiple. Okay. And the company was being anticipated as, you know, being used as a platform company. So they had a bunch of other businesses across the United States and kind of similar verticals. And the goal was to kind of roll them all up underneath of my brand, AllClean. That was that initial kind of goal. So because of that, I think I was able to get a little bit better than your typical standard multiple with it, as far as like the range that I had heard. And it was good enough for me to kind of jump into it. Of course, when you write the big check to Uncle Sam, that is like a kick to the face a little bit when you have to pay the taxes on it. I was like, oh, that one stung. But it still was good for where we were at with our family.
So did you have somebody like riding with you on the whole journey, or were you just kind of pinging people here or there? Hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And they don't really understand where you are exactly in the process.
I mean, I was pinging people, yes, but they were people that knew me, knew what I was looking to do. I trusted them. They had enough context and backgrounds, as well as more experience than I did in exits, to be able to kind of guide me and coach me through it. And that's one thing that I've always been really intentional with, is trying to, you know, build out my network and build out those connections of trusted advisors.
Was there anything that didn't go really well during the exit process?
Oh, yeah.
What, you mean it's not perfect? And then tomorrow you get the wire or the check?
No, it's, you know, it was hard. It was definitely hard. I would say, without, you know, giving away too much as far as, you know, what may be potentially, you know, giving away too much information on the deal, it didn't end up being a great culture fit. And it's something that I didn't give a whole lot of thought and consideration about. So, you know, case in point, a lot of policies and things kind of changed very, very quickly when the hands changed. And that led to a lot of customers calling me and complaining, which hurt. It led to a lot of my employees calling me and complaining and quitting. And there was about 3/4 of the employees that were working for me quit within the first year. And I got calls from every single one of them. And that was very, very hard, you know, and it had to do with, you know, just even small things like policies on, you know, purchasing equipment. And, you know, were they empowered to do that, or did they have to pay for it with their own bank account and they get reimbursed? You know, the quality of the safety stuff that we did, you know, just certain things that I was very intentional about building a culture that showed a lot of, you know, love and support. And I think that it ended up turning into be a little bit more transactional in nature with the culture of the inbound company. Mm-hmm. So the company shrank, and that was hard to see as well. And so it was definitely hard. It was hard to kind of witness that. And it was a learning lesson. It was a painful learning lesson, but it did help me, you know, think, wow, this is a really, really important thing to consider for any future exits that I may do, and even how I would do acquisitions, and really giving that a lot of attention and unpacking what the culture of the company looks like before we even, you know, start kind of getting too much down the road with a negotiation process. Because culture is one of those things that just kind of doesn't really get weighed in a lot of acquisition deals, and it should be.
This is good. Because I think most people just kind of think that it's just a transaction, and you had the relationships with the people over the years that you built the company. I imagine those were employees that didn't just join the year before you sold it. Like, you had pretty long lasting relationships with them, and even with the customers, right? Once you become the service provider, you don't want to let those folks down. And when you transition it and somebody else does things differently, that could be a good or a bad thing, but the last thing you want is the people who entrusted you or trusted you to be negatively impacted as a result of that.
Exactly. Yeah. It's hard saying, I'm sorry for letting you down dozens and dozens of times with employees, customers, you know, because you're just like, why did you sell? You know, all of a sudden it feels like a very selfish thing that you did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had to endure pain and suffering because of that decision that you made. So, you know, at the end of the day though, you know, everyone transitions to their other jobs. They transition into other you know, careers, and, you know, no one went destitute because of it, but it was painful enough for me to never, ever forget that and to always make sure that I weigh that into the mix in the future.
A lot of people want to unlock their ultimate potential, but lack the strategy, support, and stamina necessary to achieve their major goals. They often try to overcome these challenges by trying to do it on their own, causing frustration, fatigue, and eventually failure. We have developed a model for a center life, aka the red pill, to help them bolster their beliefs, gain clarity on their path to success, and provide accountability as they take action on their goals. When they take the red pill, they rapidly accelerate attainment of their goals and begin to experience a life of significance and impact. Want to find out more? Hop over to JeromeMyers.co. Now, let's get back to the episode.
Why did you sell outside of it was a really good offer from a multiple standpoint?
I think for a lot of reasons. You know, number one, you have to remember that my whole life was watching a window cleaning company. My dad had that window cleaning company for 33 years, you know, yeah. And, you know, Brandon's carrying on the torch and kind of like, you know, same name, All Clean. And it was one of those things too, where I was eager to try something new. I wanted to try something else. I felt like, man, I've learned a lot. I'd really like to see what other business models could use my skill sets. And I just wanted to try something different. I wanted to see if I had the chops for it. I wanted some cash to be able to invest in something else. And part of the cash that I used from that sale was actually to buy another business that, you know, we were able to kind of transition over. And I was able to, you know, launch my business coaching company, you know, kind of with that transition. So, and that's been led to one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done in my life. And is, you know, there's a level of pride that you have when you see that you've cleaned something for someone. That's good, feels good. Yeah. But there's a different level when you help change someone's life and they say that, you know, you've radically transformed their business and now they have time freedom and now they're experiencing these things, that it's just a completely different level of fulfillment. And I was craving that. And I kind of had a taste of it before I actually sold All Clean and started doing some coaching and started kind of getting involved and helping some people out and seeing their successes. Yeah. And it was like, when I was comparing the two, as far as like, you know, happiness and fulfillment I got from cleaning stuff, as opposed to this, I was like, I got to make a change. And so that was a big motivator as well.
Okay. You know, it's funny because the American dream, where most of us are taught from childhood, is, you know, get good grades after you get into a good school, then get a good job and have 2.5 kids after you get married and the dog and 2 luxury cars and a fence. And you have all this stuff. And then you're supposed to climb the ladder. And then once you get up the ladder, you know, you eventually retire. You hope to live for more than 10 years after you retire, and that you just don't run out of money. And for a lot of people, they start questioning. You're like, man, is this really it? What am I doing all this for? And like, or they actually achieve the financial freedom that they've been pursuing, but then they're like, this isn't it. Mm-hmm. And so you get the check, right? You said you made that promise to your wife at a really dark time in the world. Mm-hmm. And you said, give me 5 years and I'm gonna build it up and I'm gonna sell this thing. Did you find that when you got the check, it scratched the edge? Did the light turn on when you got the check?
Mm. That's a great question, Jerome. I'd say that it did scratch a niche. It scratched a niche from a perspective of, now, first of all, it wasn't FU money. It wasn't like, I'm retiring, baby. You know, we're living in the Bahamas. Like, you know, I paid Uncle Sam. I paid off, you know, so the debts of the vehicles and the other assets and things that I had. And then, you know, I knew that it was going to run out. This was not enough cash to carry us on. And so then I used an additional proceeds of that to buy another business. So my wife thought I was crazy. She's like, where did all our money go? We just got this big check and now it's almost gone. And it was scary, but it was, you know, moving in this direction that where I felt like was an even bigger opportunity. I don't think the itch of being an entrepreneur and growing things will ever go away.
Okay.
I'm wired to create. I'm wired to, you know, I call it contentedly ambitious. So I'm extremely content with where I'm at. I feel incredibly blessed. I am absolutely happy with my family life, what I do for work, my career, you know, my work-life balance. I'm very, very content with where I'm at. I don't thrive. I'm not motivated by material things. You know, I drive a used pickup truck. We have a used minivan. You know, I didn't go buy a Lamborghini or something that wouldn't do anything for me.
You didn't buy any trophies?
No.
To celebrate the exit? Nothing.
No.
Not even a bicycle. One guy came on, he bought a bicycle, a $600 beach cruiser. You didn't buy anything?
No, I bought nothing.
What?
Not to say I don't like, you know, some nice things, but no.
No dinner? No trip? No dinner, no trip, no nothing.
I mean, we did, sure. Like, you know, $100 a plate dinner. You know, my wife and I went out and celebrated and had like a nice, you know, a nice dinner. But, you know, but my point is that for me, the motivation has always been time freedom and allowing things to grow. To me, healthy things grow. And so now I have a portfolio of, you know, 11 different companies that all have CEOs and GMs and full management teams that build each one of those. And I have no day-to-day responsibilities in any of those businesses. And it's been incredibly fulfilling because I have, you know, stakeholders and equity partners, and I'm able to help them achieve their dreams and their goals. And I'm able to create things from scratch and let them, you know, it's incredibly fulfilling. So I'm still ambitious, but I'll never sacrifice my time in the pursuit of material things. It doesn't do anything for me. So, you know, with that being said, like more the impact of what happens with my business partners and with my employees and my team members and being able to create things for them. One of my favorite quotes is Zig Ziglar. You can have everything you want in life if you help enough other people get what it is that they want. And that's been kind of my primary focus. If I focus on that, money comes, all the other stuff happens, growth happens, but like that's the singular focus is just serving others, people on my team, and figuring out how to add value to others.
This is good. You're kicking the fulfillment beehive that I think most people end up figuring out that that's what the F is, right? A lot of people chase financial freedom and then they realize I was chasing the wrong F. Fulfillment is really what I want. And it's like, why did I do all this stuff when it's not even the thing I truly desire? And so you've hit the bell a few times and I want to acknowledge that I believe you're absolutely on the right path and you're enjoying it. I don't know if I could get the big check after all that you went through in order to build that company and say my only celebratory event was eating a steak or whatever. That was $100 a plate, but you know, it's all good. I mean, to each his own, trip or something. I don't know. But anyway, the fact is you went and you built a portfolio company, but Brent, I've got to ask, like, did you experience this phenomenon? Some people call it existential crisis, but we call it the founder's exit paradox. And this is when you start feeling these conflicted feelings where it's like, ooh, what is life about? What was the purpose? And it's usually brought on when somebody loses somebody, think death, think some other type of tragedy that happens. But this is because you had a significant achievement. Did you go through anything that felt like that on your journey?
Maybe describe it a little bit more for me. So I think I understand what you're asking, but you know, maybe give me another scenario of how someone might feel kind of going through that transition so I can better understand.
Yeah, a podcast I was listening to yesterday, they were talking about Olympic athletes. And so after they win gold, many of them kind of fall off of a cliff of emotional turmoil because what do they do now?
Right. Okay. Yeah.
They've hit the peak and it's like, oh, is there another mountain or like is life over? Like, have I done the best that I can do?
Yeah, for me, I'd say that, first of all, I've witnessed this. I've mm-hmm. witnessed this with thousands of business owners that I've coached, that Conquer has coached. And one of the things we talk a lot about is having people like really clearly identify their why. And the connecting statement that we typically have to get people to find their why is, so that I can do what? So someone says, I want to build a company and I want to sell for $100 million. That's their pinnacle. That's their goal. It's very surface level. Okay, great. So that you can do what? Well, I have $100 million so that I can buy all my family houses and things. Okay, great. So that you can do what? Like, you just keep going multiple levels and you go deeper and deeper and deeper and kind of get to what is the underlying why? Uh-huh. And for me, my why has always been time freedom. It's always been family. It's always been understanding what it is that I'm capable of. It's always been leveling up in life. I want to be the best I've ever been today and the worst I'll ever be. And that's my mantra every day, is just to be a better human and level up somehow, something, and fulfilling more of just my human potential is what that means. And it's not tied to how much money I can make. My goal is not like, I want to be a billionaire so that you can do what? Like, well, what is the thing? And then the other thing is that you can start doing a lot of those things that you consider to be the destination. You can start doing those today. You don't have to wait for some big thing. Oh, so that you can spend time with your family, so that you can do this. Do that today. Build your business in a way to where you can enjoy your why now without having to wait on this big, long, delayed gratification type of timeline. Because oftentimes, all the sacrifices that you think you have to make for this future end date, when you arrive there and then look back and see all that you sacrificed, you realize dang, that wasn't worth it. So I've never really had those types of existential crises, because to me, the journey is the destination. Mm-hmm. And I just have a tremendous amount of, I've already arrived. There's nowhere to be, there's nowhere to get, and I've already arrived. This, what I do every day, I have such immense pleasure out of doing it, an immense amount of fulfillment. I'm, work from home every single day. This is my home office. I eat lunch with my kids every day. I don't work in the evenings. I don't work in the weekends. I am present, because that's my why. So, no matter what, accolades and celebrations I kind of experience down the road, it'll be cool. They'll be neat, because, those types of things are kind of like a physical observance of how much value you've created, which is cool and the cool acknowledgement, but it's not a main driver for me. I'm not perfect at it by any means. I'm not some unicorn that just has unlocked something incredible. I definitely have moments, where I just like everyone else, where, I have imposter syndrome and I feel like I suck and I don't want to do this anymore. And I have doubts, but I really try to always recenter myself on that.
It sounds like you practice stoicism. Is that part of the game?
I definitely, I have read some Ryan Holiday. I'd say I definitely resound with a lot of, stoic thinking. I wouldn't consider myself a purist stoic, but I definitely get a lot of fulfillment of just kind of being present. I also have, other faith belief systems as well that motivate me. But yeah, I like to have that type of an outlook on life for sure. I think a lot of those kind of tie into it.
Where did you learn that?
Boy, that's a really good question, Jerome. Where did I learn that? I'd say that I probably have learned it mostly through observations, coaching people and being surrounded by a lot of people who have hit the big payoff and are miserable, hit the big payoff and they're divorced and they don't talk to their kids and have sacrificed all the things under the flag of, I want to sacrifice my family on the altar of business and, but I'm doing it for them. It's just such a, I'd say that's part of it, is witnessing that part. The other part is my wife. My wife has very, very high criticality. She's a fighter. She calls out my bull crap as it's there. And with that type of friction has forged an unbelievable partnership and marriage. And she hasn't let me get away with certain things and holds me accountable to getting things done. And I'd say that, she's been the perfect complement to me to be able to kind of balance my mindset with, what I'm able to accomplish, and always making sure it's tempered on what our core why is that we both agreed upon. So I have a pretty amazing partner in crime. I'd say that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys are creating crime. It sounds like you are making art. I mean, you're making this life one that you're definitely enjoying the journey as well and the roses along the way. I just find so many founders are not present on the journey.
Yeah, it's true.
They feel guilty when they're doing the family thing. They feel guilty when they're doing the work thing. And it's like they're never actually where they're supposed to be or feel good about where they are. And I just think it's a travesty.
I think it comes from a place of we overvalue what we can personally contribute to our businesses.
Yeah.
And there's a really great resource for your listeners that want to Google the Dunning-Kruger curve, Dunning-Kruger. And it has these two axes. One axis is our competency, our knowledge of what we like understand, this bottom axis, the x-axis. The y-axis is our confidence level. When you know almost nothing, your confidence is really low. Once you start to know a little bit, your confidence like rocket ships, you know, just like woo, spikes up real high. The peak of that, they call it Child's Hill, because children are often this way. You know, they know everything, right? Because they have this little bit of life experience, they've gotten some wins, and now their confidence is super high. But then it drops off radically to what's called the Valley of Despair. And this is where your confidence is low because you realize how you really actually know nothing. And the movement of you learning a little bit more opens your eyes to how much more there is yet to learn. And fortunately for me, that happened really quickly in my entrepreneurial journey where I realized like, I know nothing about this. And the more that I kind of progress forward, the more I realize how much smarter other people are than me. And who am I to try to figure out this stuff? I just need to go find people that are way smarter than me and like bring them in to this. And so, you know, the hustle, grind, 80, 100 hours a week, it's worth it. The sacrifices and then this. I hate that culture of founders. I hate those influencers out there that champion that because I think that they're creating this people that just are good, will eventually look back and be like, what have I done? And so I'm really kind of that anti-culture. And I'm like, no, you know, there's more important things in our life. Stop from a place of hubris thinking that you're the one that needs to do everything and, you know, build something to outlive you.
It's funny. One of the most profound quotes that I've heard over the past 12 months is, the more valuable you are to your business, the less valuable your business is. And I think
you use that point
so well.
That's good.
Because if it's all on you when one bus comes, then it's a disaster.
That's right.
I would be using this 1 bus, 2 bus, 5 bus metaphor for probably.
Yeah. How many people need to get hit by a bus for your business to cease to exist? You don't want that number to be low. You want it to be as high as possible. I like that quote. I'm going to borrow that too. That's nice.
So Bruno, as we wrap up, man, I got two questions for you. The first one is, who else should we have on the show, man? Folks who exit successfully usually know other folks who have exited successfully. And we just want to bring the listeners the best and the brightest.
That's a great question. There's so many people that I would throw their hat in the ring when it comes to being valuable like that. One of them is Tommy Mello. He wrote the book Home Service Millionaire. Has built his company up from zero to close to 300 million so far. He's just a total rock star. He's on a path to exit and is kind of going for the VC route. So he hasn't fully exited yet, but he's definitely going that way. Another gentleman is the name of Carl Allen, and he's actually my personal business coach and mentor. And he's actually done over 370 deals totaling about $60 billion. And he knows the M&A space and, you know, everything like the back of his hand. And he's coaching me. I pay him a lot of money to coach me because, and I always will. I always have someone coaching me way smarter than me. So he's definitely, I'd say those are two incredibly smart individuals that, you know, certainly if you can, you know, see if they'd be interested to hop on.
Hey, Tommy and Carl, you heard it. Brandon tapped you, man. You got to jump in the ring. Got to jump in the ring, man. It's tagged.
Our man, Jerome.
Let's go. All right. And then the final question, man, is what's the one thing you want the listeners to take away from this episode? You talked about coaching a lot, being exposed to people who have done it, which has allowed you to not make a lot of the common mistakes that we hear that founders make when they go it on their own. Ooh, what's the one thing you want the listeners to take away?
Don't fall into the DIY death trap, the do-it-yourself death trap. You know, we sometimes feel compelled to do it ourselves to save money. We feel compelled to do it ourselves because it sounds too expensive to go hire someone. Any good employee, they will never be a liability to your company. The cost is irrelevant. I'll give you a case in point. There's a gentleman I met who is an employee of a company. He makes in HVAC. He makes $1 million a year in W-2 earnings, doesn't own equity, but he sells $12 million a year personally in residential HVAC sales. Like, would you pay someone $1 million a year if they could bring in $12 million? Of course. Money is irrelevant, you know? And so, you know, for me, I've hired CEOs of companies for some of my companies that, you know, make multiple six figures and have opportunity to earn equity. I'd much rather own a smaller piece of a pie, a much, much, much larger pie than 100% of a small pie. And, you know, the quicker that, if I could go back in time, the quicker I would implement some of those lessons. And, you know, that would be the biggest thing that I'd want someone to kind of take away from this is it's all in the team. It's all in Steve Jobs said, you can, you know, I don't hire people, so I tell them what to do. I hire smart people, so they tell me what to do. He did all right for himself. Steve Jobs.
I think he did okay. You know, I think it's reasonable. Man, this was powerful, Brandon. Thank you for jumping on with me today, man.
My pleasure.
Sharing some of the lessons, kind of the war story. That I think we learn so much more from the things that don't go well than the things that do. And anytime you can learn from somebody else's experiences and use that to avoid those, what I call rookie mistakes, I think you put yourself in a better position. I think you've helped the listeners by just sharing your journey and your experience. It was funny because you were going through some of the things that we've identified the apex performers do. One is total financial ruin or something very close to it at one point. Another one we've seen is people losing someone that was close to them when they were young. Another is this feeling that you got to prove yourself, right? Mm. And sometimes it's people pleasing. Sometimes it's chip on your shoulder. I'm going to make sure that everybody knows I'm the biggest and the baddest. There's a couple of more that we see. For me, one of the two is suicidal ideation. And then your depression, depending on however you want to describe it. And, you know, I checked the boxes for all five, right? And I think people pretend like it's all good and it's never hard or you didn't go through any trauma or whatever you want to call it. But there's a reason why these folks end up being extraordinary. They went through something and that hardened them, and that hardening allowed them to walk through some of those valleys or the fire or whatever you want to call it, that process that allowed them to be somebody who others would follow and they would look fear right in the face, right in the eye and say, you know what? In spite of you being here, I'm going to demonstrate that I actually have the courage in order to face you and beat the boss of this level or slay the dragon that's at the end of the board. As much as entrepreneurship is romanticized these days, there's just so much more to it that nobody ever talks about. And, you know, that's why we're having this conversation. We want to normalize eight-figure exits. We want to normalize people knowing what it actually takes to get there, because it's not just the Ferraris and the Rolexes.
Right.
And
everyone sees the wine. No one sees the crushing of the grapes.
Yeah, yeah. You got to go through the process. And
your grapes get crushed, for sure, is being an entrepreneur. Yeah, it's, you know, one thing that you said that, you know, really struck me is, you know, normalizing the uncomfortability and the pain and the hardship that kind of comes along with this journey. If it was easy, everyone would do it, first of all. And secondly, like, growth is tied to pain. If you go to the gym and you lift, you know, heavy weights, you literally tear your muscles. That's why it hurts so bad when you lift. And you have to get to that really depth of pain, nearly to failure, where in order for your muscles to grow bigger. Anything that we do in life that's tied to growth of any kind is going to come with that. So you almost kind of have to chase the pain to some extent when you're an entrepreneur. And then when you experience it, you got to like take it and really, you know, breathe it in. And I'd always take out a video camera and I document myself when I'm curled up on the, you know, couch crying like a baby, talking about how terrible things are. And then I'd save them in a folder and I'd watch them later. when I was like celebrating some wins.
After you went through it. Yeah.
That's what got here. And if I can make it through that, like sometimes I laugh at him. I'm like, I can't believe I'm crying like a baby about that thing. That wasn't even that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But at the time it felt soul crushing, you know, but it just makes for a better story in a podcast or on a stage. And I find that every founder has a story that's similar to it, which is pretty encouraging too.
If they're willing to share it, there's a lot of founders out there who won't share any of their stuff because they're worried about how it's going to make them look. It's too bad, man. Everybody who's actually on the journey and having success knows that there's a story behind the story.
Yeah, so that's right.
With that, listeners, if you're out there and you want some help with J-Figure exit, and you're curious about how to avoid the founder's exit paradox, jump over to the exitparadox.com and grab our, we got a little guide there, man. We wrote a white paper to help you understand the 6 centers of doubt that every founder experiences once they exit. Until the next time, your dreams should be real. We'll talk soon.
Thank you for joining the tribe today. We would love to hear from you. Please don't forget to rate, like, and share. Perhaps someone you know could benefit from what we've discussed. Until the next time, remember that your dreams should be real.